It's not an option. It's a right. Cocked, locked, and ready to rock the world of the anti-gunners. You are listening to the guy who had to register his mouth as a full auto weapon. Bill Carnes and 2A Radio. The fight for your rights isn't for pansies. So buckle up for the ride and knuckle down with Bill Carnes and 2A Radio.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Welcome. Now, here is some breaking news. I just got this yesterday afternoon about this time. The California ammunition bill, ammunition ban bill, AB 962, was ruled unconstitutional by a California court. Now, AB 962 was passed about a year ago, and what it said was, as of February, I believe, 11th of this year, 2/11/11, that you certain handgun ammunition, which there's a bunch of different calibers, if you wanted to buy it, you had to go to an authorized dealer, give fingerprints, show photo ID, they would keep records, had to be out of the hands so where the customers couldn't even grab it and look at it to see what they were buying. And I have said that originally in the bill it was 50 rounds a month maximum limit, and you could only do that every 30 days. I've had a couple of emails that said that they dropped that, but I can't find that. So anyhow, let me read this to you. In a dramatic ruling giving gun owners a win in a National Rifle Association / California Rifle and Pistol Foundation lawsuit, yesterday morning, Fresno Superior Court Judge Jeffrey Hamilton ruled that AB 962, the hotly contested statute that would have banned mail order ammunition sales and required all purchases of so-called handgun ammunition to be registered, that was unconstitutionally vague on its face. The court enjoined enforcement of the statute so mail order ammunition sales to California can continue unabated and ammunition sales need not be registered under the law. Now, this is just in the nick of time because most mail order ammunition companies have said that they'll stop taking orders in California after the 21st of this month, in just 2 days. Now they don't need to do that. The lawsuit was prompted in part by the many objections and questions raised by confused police, ammunition purchasers, and sellers about what ammunition is covered by the new laws created by AB 962. In a highly unusual move that reflects growing law enforcement opposition to inventive gun control laws, Tehama County Sheriff Clay Parker is the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit, which is a huge surprise because generally it's the sheriffs and the police chiefs that are behind this type of garbage. In this case, it's not. Other plaintiffs include the CRPA Foundation, Herb Bauer Sporting Goods, ammunition shipper Abel's Ammo, collectible ammunition shipper RTG Sporting Collectibles, and individual Steven Stonecipher. Let's see, Mendocino Sheriff Tom Allman also supported the lawsuit. The ruling comes just days before the portion of the law that bans mail order sales of so-called handgun ammunition was set to take effect on February 1st, 2011. So I was off on the date. The lawsuit, Parker v. California, is funded exclusively by the NRA and the CRPA Foundation. If it had gone into effect, AB 962 would have imposed burdensome and ill-conceived restrictions on the sales of ammunition. AB 962 required that handgun ammunition be stored out of the reach of customers, that ammunition vendors collect ammunition sales registration information and thumbprints from purchasers, and conduct transactions face-to-face for all deliveries and transfers of handgun ammunition. The lawsuit successfully sought the declaration from the court that the statute was unconstitutional and successfully sought the injunctive relief prohibiting law enforcement from enforcing the new laws. Now, in addition to all of this, family members couldn't give ammunition back and forth. That was also prevented in AB 962. All right. There's also been a federal lawsuit against this by the union that represents drivers for a lot of delivery services such as UPS, FedEx, DHL, things such as that. Because there is a federal law which covers through interstate commerce that these guys and the shipping companies don't have to be ruled by state and local laws on different things that get shipped. There's federal statutes, and that's all they have to follow. This would have required them, if someone shipped ammo in, these guys would have had to have gone through all of the laws that a retailer would have had to gone through, getting copies of photo ID, thumbprints, logging stuff, and all of that garbage. So, as it turns out, they no longer have to actually deal with their federal lawsuit, which is nice. Let's see. Despite this win for common sense and ill-conceived and counterproductive gun laws, additional legislation on this and related subjects will no doubt be proposed in Sacramento this legislative session. Well, of course. Here's the deal. The anti-gunners in California, if you first don't succeed, try again. That is their motto. And they will. Continue, he says, it is absolutely critical that those who believe in the right to keep and bear arms stay informed and make their voices heard in Sacramento. Well, they might be heard, but they're not really going to be listened to. When AB 962 passed, there was a loud outcry from law-abiding gun owners impacted by the new law. Those voices must be heard during the legislative session and before a proposed gun law passes, not after it is signed. So to help, if you're in California, if you'd like to learn about the legislative alerts, you can go to calnra.com and they will send out emails. So there you go. AB 962 is dead. The Wicked Witch is dead. The Wicked Witch is dead. Now, constitutional vagueness is rarely something that really gets hammered on in the courts when people challenge laws. And here's the other thing. You have a lot of private money to fight a law that was unconstitutional when it was written, unconstitutional when it was discussed in committee, unconstitutional when it went through the House in California, unconstitutional in committee and through the Senate in the state of California, unconstitutional as it waited for the governor's signature, and unconstitutional when the governor signed it. All of those areas could have looked at the constitutionality of this law. None of them did, which is exactly what happens at every state level and every federal level for the most part. It had to wait till it was signed into law. And then people who would be negatively impacted by it had to cough up the money in order to fight it. That is a broken spoke in this wheel of our republic. That somehow needs to be fixed to where constitutionality is looked at and considered before a bill is introduced, which is why I applaud the Republicans who, John Boehner, who took over as the Speaker of the House, that they're changing the rules in the House for this session for the 112th Congress. Every piece of legislation introduced must cite the part of the Constitution which provides the legality and the constitutional authority to introduce such a bill. Stay tuned, guys. There's more to come after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
Tell everyone in the room to pipe down. 2A Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
And welcome back, everyone. I'm going to read to you a letter, which is actually, it's about 6 weeks old. It was written on December 6th, 2010. And this is from a certain section of the Congress of the United States. And it is part of the Congressional Prayer Group, if I remember correctly. Let me read this to you. This is in response to all of the garbage that Obama spews in his speeches. Thanks to the way he puts them together, wants to deny God, doesn't put God or creator in any of his speeches, absolutely denies it, makes us a secular society, just a completely godless society, pardon me, is really what he tries to make America as. So it's addressed to President Barack Obama. Dear Mr. President, We write today in response to a speech given on November 10th, 2010 at the University of Indonesia in Jakarta, Indonesia, in which you stated, quote, "But I believe that the history of both America and Indonesia should give us hope. It is a story written into our national mottos. In the United States, our motto is E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Our nations show that hundreds of millions who hold different beliefs can be united in freedom under one flag." So, what he's talking about is a one world government of one there is many. Almost like if, you know, resistance is futile, we are the Borg and we're going to come assimilate you. Now, continuing with this letter, it says, E pluribus unum is not our national motto. In 1956, Congress passed and President Eisenhower approved the law establishing In God We Trust as the official national motto of the United States. This motto is also referenced in our national anthem and is engraved on our coins and currency. Additionally, during three separate events this fall, when quoting from the Declaration of Independence, you mentioned that we have inalienable rights, but consequently failed to mention the source of the rights. The Declaration of Independence definitely recognizes God, our Creator, as the source of our rights. Omitting the word Creator once was a mistake, but twice establishes a pattern. And of course, he did it three times. If your speech in Indonesia, in your speech in Indonesia, you mentioned being unified under one flag. The Pledge of Allegiance to our flag says that we are one nation under God. As President of the United States, you are our representative to the rest of the world. By misrepresenting things as foundational as the Declaration of Independence and our national motto, you are not only doing a disservice to the people you are You're not only doing a disservice to the people you represent, you are casting aside an integral part of American society. I'm sorry, I have to apologize for my stumbling. I'm reading a PDF, which is a very low format, and I'm increased the size, and it's just fuzzy. So, that's why I sound like a third grader as I'm reading this. John Adams said, quote, "It is religion and morality alone which can establish the principles upon the freedoms that securely stand." If Adams was right, by making these kinds of statements to the rest of the world, you are removing one of the cornerstones of our secure freedom. If we pull the thread of religious conviction out of the marketplace of ideas, we unravel the tapestry of freedom that birthed America. As members of the Congressional Prayer Caucus, a bipartisan group of 68 members of the United States House of Representatives, we are dedicated to preserving America's religious heritage and protecting our religious liberty. We respectfully request that you issue a correction to the speech you gave, as it does not appropriately reflect America and serves to undercut the importance of part of our history. We are willing to meet with you to discuss further if you would like. As President Ronald Reagan warned, quote, "If we ever forget that we're one nation under God, then we will be a nation gone under." Sincerely, and it has 68 representatives who signed this thing. And it's fantastic. I love it. It's telling Obama, look, we're aware that you continuously diss God. As in, like, the Christian God, Jesus Christ. And by doing that, you allegedly have Christian beliefs. But of course, you correct yourself sometimes because if you say Muslim, I mean my Christian beliefs, my Christian upbringing. Right. Your Muslim is a day as long. That's it. That's it. That's all there is to it. You completely and continuously diss God over and over and over again. And that's got to be a standing order in the White House at the speechwriter's desk. Nothing about God. Let's redo this. Of one there is many. That's the national motto. Right. What a jackass. Just drives me nuts. Just so you guys know, this week happens to be the week of the SHOT Show, the Shooting, Hunting, and Outdoor Trades Exposition in Las Vegas, which is hop, skip, and a jump for me. It's 45 minutes away. So, I actually spent yesterday at the SHOT Show, and I was lining up a number of different interviews, which I'll be conducting later this week. I'm there again. Well, I was there again today. So just so everybody knows, what we're going to be doing is this week we now start talking about gear and different things that are out there. A number of the companies that I have lined up and people I have lined up to do interviews with are with companies that produce good products, things that I have experience with or that I guess I should say the colleagues in the industry that I have experience with. Good stuff, good products. Now, of course, there's thousands upon thousands of vendors that are there. I can't get to all of them. I can't do interviews with everybody. If I did, that would soak up an entire year worth of shows or more. So I'm going to be doing some different interviews here and there. So the rest of the week, you're actually going to hear from some of the different companies that are out there. If you happen to have a request, if there's a company you'd like to hear about or hear from, shoot me an email, bill@2aradio.com. Let me know who you'd like me to interview and why. And if I get enough requests along that lines, I'll seek them out, let them know that the listeners would like to hear from them, and that's what we're going to do. I have 5 or 6 interviews lined up. Each interview is going to be 1 segment. We do 4 segments per show. So at least that's the plan for now. Also, a lot of the folks from Top Shot are in, about half of the group, probably 8 or 9 of the 16, I think, are in Vegas for the SHOT Show. Plus, History Channel just announced on Sunday the cast for Top Shot Season 2. Top Shot Season 2 was cast, it's been filmed, it's in the can, and it premieres sometime in February, I think mid-February. And as a matter of fact, they're in the process of casting for Top Shot Season 3. They're looking for teams, like husband, wife, brother, sister, something like that. So if boyfriend, girlfriend, maybe, something like that. If there's a team out there, you can go to History Channel. You can go to history.com and look up and put in for Top Shot Season 3. Anyhow, tonight we're supposed to be getting together informally, just the group. I think Season 1, the original cast, and Season 2 cast that are in town are supposed to get together. And then Thursday night, we're all getting together in a much bigger event at the Gordon Biersch in Las Vegas on Paradise and Flamingo Road, about a mile or a mile and a half from the Sands Convention Center, which is where SHOT Show is actually happening this year. I think they're signed up for the Sands Convention Center for the next 7 years, I believe, at least. I believe they're through 2017. Is where the SHOT Show is going to be. Anyhow, so that sort of thing's going to happen. I might open up the microphone and record some of the conversations, do some interviews, and play that back on the air over the next couple of days. But just so you can expect the type of show that's going to be coming for the rest of the week and maybe even into the very first part of next week. So I just want to give everybody a heads up about that. Again, if you have any interview requests, send them to me, bill@2aradio.com. As far as that goes. Now, I would like you to stay tuned because there's plenty more to come after the break. You're going to want to hear some of these things. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
You're listening to a guy who packs a gun to shoot the bad guys and packs a mic to shoot his mouth off. Bill Carnes and 2A Radio are back.
Hey guys, welcome back. You know, I was just speaking on Monday's show, if memory serves correct, that the level of police firearms training in this country is pathetically low. And it is low because the trainers, the departments, and the officers, for the most part, really don't understand what a higher level of firearms training even is, that it even exists. Certainly not how to get there. And then the trainers, almost across the board, have no idea how to train to a higher level in an efficient manner on top of that. It's just, it escapes them. I really put the industry standard of firearms training, I've said this before, I'll say it again, in terms of football. The average industry standard level of firearms training would be that of about high school junior varsity ball, right? Not realizing that there's a varsity level, junior college, college, semi-pro, and professional football out there. Not even realizing that all these levels above them exist. They just don't know. And it's a fact of ignorance. And I don't say this to be an ass about it. I just say that's the way it is. And people trust, the general population trusts that cops know how to use a gun, they know how to shoot, because they carry a gun every day and they've got to go through some sort of firearms training. It is pathetic, the firearms training that most departments go through. And if it's a regular old street cop, they get the least amount of training of everybody on the department. They have to move up in levels, up to higher levels, higher threat level groups within the police community to get more advanced firearms training. Not the folks who are on the street, who are truly the first responders. Actually, the second responders. I guess you are a first responder, which is why you should be packing every day. So here's this story. It says, new study says police firearms training sucks, which really got my attention. Let me read this to you. Just got an email blast from ForensicScience.org. A new study by Dr. Gregory Morrison finds law enforcement training woefully inadequate. The former officer and firearms instructor, now an associate CJ professor at Indiana's Ball State University, doesn't quite put it that way, but he should have. Amongst his findings, one, in terms of time allocation, quote, many departments still heavily emphasize requalifying over vital handgun deadly force training that introduces new skills and improves existing ones. Now, I can attest to that. When I was a Las Vegas Metro officer, we had to qualify quarterly, which is much more often than a lot of departments that qualify twice a year and sometimes once a year. Of those four times a year we had to qualify, three times were just shoot the qualification, whatever we happened to come up with. And, you know, to their credit, they would at least change the qualification a little bit so it helped to practice beforehand if you didn't have basic fundamentals, which they didn't know how to provide to you. Once a year, you'd actually do something a little more exciting, and they'd train you a little bit, and then you'd shoot that new qualification. That's the way it went, at least when I was there in the mid-90s. Here's another one. Two, despite their vital role, nearly 40% of agencies do not require firearms instructors to take refresher training once they have been certified. 40% once you get the job you're in. Now, larger departments, which statistically have greater exposure to armed encounters, tend to require fewer firearms training and requalification sessions per year. Why? Budget is what they claim. That's what they cry. Here's another. Officers on some agencies are able to pass requalification tests even though many of their shots miss the target entirely, and those who fail to qualify may be allowed to reshoot until they squeak by, quote, sometimes without diagnostic or corrective intervention. Just keep shooting until it works. That certainly has happened, at least on the department I was on. On the whole, quote, the overreaching characteristic of in-service firearms training is the wide latitude exercised by departments, essentially a jumble of inconsistent standards and instructional mandates that too often works to the detriment of officers, agencies, and the communities they serve. Absolutely on par. Again, this is a piece written by Dr. Gregory Morrison, who's a CJ professor at Indiana's Ball State University, and this was available from ForensicScience.org, if you'd like to look that up and get the entire email and hunt it down and see this entire thing. Now, I gotta tell you, that the police firearms training is not only woefully inadequate, they cry budget concerns. However, if you look at some of the larger departments in the country, and the guys that are the departments that are crying about budget concerns, part of the reason they have budget concerns is they're paying out in settlements and in court decisions for things such as cops who are reckless with their guns. Maybe it's a Rule 4 problem and they miss their intended target, the bad guy, and shoot somebody else or cause damage or what have you. Because the firearms training is woefully inadequate and the people with the guns really don't know what the heck they're doing. They just don't have the fundamental principles, the foundation to be able to qualify to carry a gun in this day and age. But the police department pats them on their ass and sends them out onto the beat with a gun, hoping that they don't wreak too much havoc. So the departments that are so laden with budget crunches oftentimes have these huge settlements that they have to pay out, which comes out of their budget. If they could actually put about 10 or 15, maybe 20% of the payouts, put that money into training to dramatically limit the payouts that they have to have, the settlements that they either agree upon or a court forces them, says, you know, you got to pay this. If they were able to limit those by half or more and take 20% of the savings and put it back into firearms training, most of these departments would have it covered if they actually got the proper trainers who knew how to teach the proper training and then either trained the full-time guys to do it right or replace them with new people, or they just hired the right people. I mean, I have actually batted around the idea of trying to put together a group to go out there and do a train-the-trainer sort of a company where we would go out and teach the existing staff how to teach properly. And if they couldn't get it because people were juiced in, or they just, you know, maybe they know how to shoot a gun, but they can't teach their way out of a paper bag, which is most of the case. Generally, to become a certified firearms instructor, all you have to do is take a class. You just have to be a student. You never actually have to show that you can teach, which is a huge problem. We see that in our schools. We get teachers who don't know how to teach very well because they go through college, they get a certificate to teach, and then they go out there and they're supposed to be able to just naturally regurgitate what it is they've learned and do it effectively. You either know how to teach or you don't know how to teach. Some people can be taught how to teach if they have the desire but not the ability. If you've got the desire and the drive, all you have to do is provide somebody with the tools to teach them how to teach, which can be very difficult. Really, there's, as I look at it, three levels when it comes to shooters. You got the people that can shoot well. You've got the people that can shoot well but don't know how to teach. Or they can shoot well and they do know how to teach. Then you've got the third level. The third level is those who know how to teach other good shooters how to teach. So either you're a good shooter and you can teach, you're a good shooter and you can't teach. Or you are a good shooter and you can teach and teach others to teach. You see what I'm saying? And that's the issue, is oftentimes we're just wrapped up with these guys that can shoot okay, go through a class to get certified. Sometimes they can't even shoot. Anyhow, guys, stay tuned. There's more to come after the break. We'll be right back.
If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check, which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
As long as politicians attack our rights, Bill will be fighting for them. Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Back off, I'll take you on.
You know, we've talked about this whole border violence in Mexico. It has actually begun spilling over into the U.S., especially in Arizona. It's really starting to spill over there, but it's not getting a bunch of national media attention. Now, here's something out of Texas. At least one Mexican gunman fired a high-powered rifle across the border at four U.S. road workers this last Thursday in an isolated ghost town east of Fort Hancock, Texas, according to county sheriff officials. The bullets did not injure the four men. Mike Doyle, chief deputy of the Hudspeth County Sheriff's Office, said a rancher spotted a white pickup fleeing the area on the Mexican side at 10:30 a.m., the time the shots were fired. The bullets struck private land along the unpaved Indian Hot Springs Road, which is about half a mile from the border fence, according to Hudspeth County sheriffs. The county borrowed the land to store gravel and rocks used for road construction. The workers were filling a hole left last year by rainstorm damage. The ghost town of Fort Quitman is 25 miles east of Fort Hancock and 80 miles southeast of El Paso. Fewer than a dozen ranchers raise cattle in the remote area. Doyle said the gunman might have shot at the road workers to distract them or get them to flee. Maybe they were trying to get them outside the area, he says. Doyle said the sheriff and the Texas Rangers at this point are assuming the bullets were fired from Mexico. He said one of the county workers said he heard eight shots that, quote, sounded like high-powered rifles. So here's the interesting thing. The opening of this says they were shot at with a high-powered rifle. They have no idea what they were shot at with. On the Mexican side, the nearest community is Banderas, but there are roads that connect the Onondaga, whatever, right across from Presidio, and also Juarez. Two Texas Rangers and Hudspeth County Sheriff Arvin West, and Deputy Doyle later were at the scene looking for the bullets with a metal detector. How do they know where they landed? Drug cartels use this busy smuggling corridor in between the Quitman Mountains and mountains in the northwestern part of Chihuahua State to traffic marijuana and sometimes cocaine. The U.S. government built narrowly spaced steel poles north of the Rio Grande to fence the border in that West Texas area. The slots are not wide enough for people to cross, but small objects can fit between the 15-foot tall poles. So it's not actually stopped, it's just these poles are close. Really? What's it take, a sawzall to cut something like that down? You can walk up and stick your gun through, West said. The river where it separates Fort Quitman from Mexico is just a few feet wide. It's the first time Hudspeth County officials reported gunfire coming from across the border. And in El Paso, stray bullets from a drug-related gunfight hit City Hall last June. Another stray bullet struck a University of Texas El Paso building in August. On Falcon Lake, a border area near Laredo, Texas, American tourist David Hartley was reportedly shot by Mexican gunmen in October. The Texas Department of Public Safety, which oversees the Texas Rangers, refused to call the sheriff's officials. DPS officials said only that troopers escorted the workers and their equipment away from the scene. Okay. That's great. Brooks said the agency is not deploying more agents to the area. There's no beefing up in any way. Great. Well, maybe the governor can do something. Well, the governor says, there's spokeswoman Catherine Sissinger, says the governor's office had yet to confirm the incident. Okay, thanks. That's Governor Rick Perry, also known as Slick Rick in the state of Texas. Here's a quote. If these reports are true, it's yet another incident of border violence and spillover. You're right. So basically you just wasted your time by speaking. It goes back for the need for the federal government to provide more resources to the border, which is certainly feeling the effects of the escalating violence in Mexico. So let's pass the buck. It's your state. You are the Lone Star State. You're the one that is so happy because with just a draft of a state resolution, you're now an independent country and you give up your part in these United States. But yet it's up to the federal government to secure your border. What happened to the independence of Texas? And who is this spokesperson? Did this spokeswoman, Catherine Kessinger, actually get Governor Rick Perry's approval to say these stupid, lefty, scumbag things? Continuing, the shots from across the border angered U.S. Representative Francisco Canseco, Republican of Texas, who represents the area. He says, quote, "It is completely unacceptable that Americans at work doing their jobs in America come under gunfire from across the border in Mexico. Our border is not secure from violence that threatens American lives. Securing our border against the cartels and their violent threats must be a top priority." Now, this is a guy who I can only imagine, Francisco Canseco. I can only imagine by his name that he may be of Mexican descent. And if that's so, he's also Republican. And most folks who are from Mexico or Mexican descent tend to vote on the liberal side as Democrats, which is totally confusing to me. Because most Mexican families are Christians. They're mostly Catholics. They don't like government interference. They work hard. They want to keep what's theirs. And they believe in God and family, which are things that the left doesn't care about. They give a damn about God. Pun intended. They want to invade your family, take what you have, and rule you. So why Mexican immigrants tend to vote more lefty than on the right absolutely confuses me. Especially those who are descendants of Mexican immigrants. Anyhow. Let's see. Texas Rangers scoured an area 25 miles. He's blah, da, 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 da. Let's see. It is completely unacceptable. Anyhow, I read all that. Forget about it. I'm going to move on from this story. So what we have is we now have some unknown Mexican shooting across the border at American road workers in Texas. In Texas. Now, if I were in Texas, I would expect that the border be lined by a whole bunch of gunmen shooting back. Now, if you had Americans shooting their guns into Mexico, at Mexicans, would that cause an international uproar? Would that cause national media attention? Sure. But to have a Mexican shooting a gun at Americans in America, almost unheard of. And the response is not to bring out the National Guard, not to bring out the military, not to bring out the cops and stop it. If we were shooting into Mexico, what would happen? The federales would probably line up on the border and start shooting back. But not on our side. I don't understand this lack of tit for tat. I just don't get it. Mexico has incredibly strict enforcement on people who are illegally in their country. Incredibly strict. They are abusive to the immigrants that come into their country. And the police officials there will rob these people, take everything that they've got, and kick them back south of their border, back into Guatemala or wherever, Belize, wherever they snuck in from. And this is common practice through a corrupt organization, corrupt nation. But when we want to send people back to Mexico, Mexico cries, "Oh, you should let our people stay from Mexico, you should let them stay in the United States and give them everything for free because you're such a rich country." That's what we hear from the chief Mexican, Felipe Calderon, their president. We should absolutely bend over. I think he means backwards, but it feels as though it's forwards. When it comes to all of the people that are coming into this country from Mexico, not all of them are Mexicans. Other people will sneak into Mexico to sneak into the United States. Why? Because the border is so miserably porous. Miserably porous. I've been driving in southern Arizona on back roads and seen groups of Mexicans run across the road, run into the desert, and then doof, dive down so nobody sees them. I've seen this with my own eyes. Happening all the time. Border patrols running up and down 40 miles north of the border to catch people rather than at the border itself. Ridiculous to me. And now people are shooting across more commonly, more often than they have in the past. It's starting to spill over, folks. If you live on or around the Mexican border, you better arm yourself, you better get trained, and you better be prepared at any given moment to have to defend your life or the life of your family or other countrymen.
I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you, Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Thanks for tuning in. Bill will be back tomorrow. Now go side in and shoot straight. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. Learn more about Bill at BillCarnes.com. Send your comments to Bill at 2aradio.com.